low enough. I think they had plans on deorbiting it over the Pacific Ocean. So it's one big cylinder, you know. But yeah, they're gonna have to deal with that at some point. But you know, look how big the mirror was. That was about 1/5 the amount of weight that the International Space Station is. International Space Station weighs about 1 million pounds, so it's 1/5 of that. So call it, you know, 250,000 pounds even. And they deorbited that and came down. I remember seeing pictures of that. You know, put on some fireworks display when that re-entered the atmosphere. So I guess the same thing's going to happen. The same thing with Salyut 6 and Salyut 7. You know, that was the actual first Russian space station. And that's very similar type of design where you would go up and Salyut 6, I think you would just dock with it. And then, then leave and then would stay in orbit. Another crew would go back up, similar to what China is doing with their first one. So yeah, that's been decommissioned. And now they have a Tiangong 3. That would be a module design. That would be, in the future, but they've got plans on this, and I think that's 5 modules that they're going to interconnect, you know, with solar panels and everything. So that's their real long-term plan for a space station. But they got to get this other one done. They really need to have long-term capability, you know, exchanging crews and everything. They're going to do that to some degree with 2, but there are going to be quite a few points of time where they're not going to be able to have a crew on board permanently, so it will be unoccupied at times. Let me drop it. And talk about deorbiting things. That, you know, back in the 1970s, the Skylab deorbited. So, I mean, that wound up being spread partially around the Indian Ocean. Some of it did hit land in Australia. And there's a rumor that a piece of it, you know, killed a cow. I don't know how true that is. Back to you there.
When Mir re-entered, from your point of view, Paul, was that a controlled re-entry? In other words, they did a retro burn, and they knew that it was going to land in the Pacific Ocean, for instance. Is that what happened with Mir? And I vaguely remember some of it, a large metallic object of some kind, survived a little bit longer and ended up in Australia, I vaguely remember. I may have that confused with some other re-entry. So, if Tiangong 1 can be remotely controlled well enough with its onboard thrusters, when they're sure they're not going to use it anymore, in theory, they can order it into a retro burn where it does a controlled re-entry at some chosen location. I think you're telling me that's the plan. So, do you think Mir was a well-controlled re-entry with essentially no side effects? WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, you could, so, you know, you can get on a computer and put in Mir deorbiting, and you can see, it looks like about 20 pieces coming down at least. You know, I mean, it looks like streaks of fire in the sky, a bunch of meteors coming in. And that was done, I believe that was done over the South Pacific. But, you know, they do have pictures of that. I think they had some photography from jet planes. You know, that was definitely a controlled deorbit. And the one you were thinking about was where pieces wound up in Australia. That was Skylab when that came down. And don't forget, every time these missions that go up to the International Space Station, each one is maybe about half the size of the Tiangong 1. So, you've got the Progress missions, the Cygnus biorbital science that I mentioned before. You've got the HTV, that's the cargo mission sent up from Japan, and they all have a lot of weight, 10,000 pounds of material. The biggest ones that were, biggest cargo ones that we sent back were, from that get deorbited was from the European Space Agency. They sent five crafts up, and they were called the ATVs. They were the automatic transfer vehicles. So, quite a bit of things on a regular basis are coming down here.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
From SpaceX, that comes down, lands in the Pacific with a parachute, and of course the Soyuz spacecraft come back down and land in Kazakhstan, and that has people on it. Back to you, Dick.
When Skylab came down, and I'm kind of curious about Skylab because it had something called the L-band radiometer on board, made by Airborne Instruments Laboratory. I was working there at the time, although I wasn't associated with that project. It was in another building. So when Skylab came down, sounds like one of the times that a very large piece of hardware came down with a not-so-controlled re-entry. I mean, was there a definite plan to do a specific retro burn at a particular time to bring it down in a particular location? And if so, how did some of that hardware end up coming down in Australia? So maybe we weren't quite as skilled at bringing massive pieces of hardware back down in the Skylab days, which was in the mid-1970s. I think Skylab flew around 1973 or 74, if I remember. Back to you, Paul. K2LIW.
Yeah, after we landed, Eugene Cernan, Harrison Schmidt, Cernan being the last man on the moon, the next big thing was Skylab, and that was probably sent up, probably 1973, 74. Skylab went up on a Saturn V rocket. That was the last big Saturn V rocket to go up. And then we sent three S-4B Saturn rockets up, the shorter version of the Saturn V, and we sent three of them up, each carrying three people. So you had three crews that occupied Skylab, and it wasn't back-to-back. You didn't have all these extra ports up there. You didn't have all the, you didn't have a way to send cargo vehicles up to Skylab either. So, you brought everything with you and unloaded it. And that's what you ate, that's what you dealt with, and eventually you got it back in your same Apollo spacecraft and landed back on Earth. That first mission, that lasted 34 days, and then 54 days, and then something like 84 days, respectively, and you had three different crews. And then when they were finished with that, that thing deorbited on its own. They had plans of eventually, sending more spacecraft up and kicking it up into high orbit. This all never happened. Money ran out. Nobody had any desire left for the Skylab program. So I think they just figured the Earth is made of three quarters of the Earth of water. And I think they just rolled the dice. I don't remember. I hope they did it. I'll have to research that one a little bit better. Dick. But I don't know. I got it in the back of my head that they just hoped everything was going to go okay. Oh, it's all going to burn up. One of them. Back to you, Dick.
And the very last Apollo program was Apollo 17, as you mentioned, with Cernan, I think, being the last, Eugene Cernan being the last man on the moon. Very soon after that, we we had a American-Soviet link-up called Apollo-Soyuz. And I think that preceded Skylab, but I'm not sure. Apollo-Soyuz was a link-up between a Russian orbiting craft and an American orbiting craft. And they had designed the right kind of a docking mechanism so that the two could dock with each other, even though they had very different docking ports. So there's an adapter with an A-type docking port on one side and a B-type docking port on the other side, so these two guys can come together. And then they met each other and shook hands and traded food and whatever. And this was, I guess, one of the first operations in which we tried to become friendly. I mean, up until then, there was an awful lot of, and even after that, awful lot of fear of Soviet weaponry versus American weaponry. They apparently were quite scared that we're going to do something with our stuff that they wouldn't like, and vice versa. Let me drop. At that time, I was working on the B-1 bomber program, and I could tell by the way we were designing that hardware. We were worried. We wanted to make sure that we had the right kind of defensive slash offensive hardware that could protect us in the worst case event if there was a war that broke out between those two major nations. So Apollo-Soyuz was a kind of peacemaking operation as I see it. And I'm not sure now if that came before Skylab, but Apollo-Soyuz, those two craft, both came back down with their astronauts and cosmonauts with their hardware, although I'm not sure who brought up that docking mechanism and who brought back down that docking mechanism. Was that just a jettisoned and allowed to re-enter? And then I think Skylab followed. But it sounds like Skylab was not a very controlled re-entry, if I can remember that one correctly, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, I think you're right about Skylab, but gonna have to research that one. I'll find it once it's ran a computer, but I got some old books here that have it as well. The Soyuz Apollo mission. I credit Deke Slayton a lot with getting us involved with the Russians, what we have today. We had about five shuttles that had docked with the Mir spacecraft. People forget that. They just figured a shuttle, did solo flights and, went up and came down and eventually, started building the space station and docked with the space station, the ISS. But we had five different shuttles docking with the Mir. We sent the Americans up. We brought Russians up with us in the shuttle. But I think Dick Slayton was really head of the astronaut group and one of the original Mercury 7, and he finally got to fly, last one of that group to fly. They grounded him early on because he had some kind of a heart problem. And apparently he got it fixed or whatever, and years went by. He became 50-some-odd years old. And since he was the head of the astronaut corps, and he got to choose who goes up, he went up. But he studied his Russian, and he was pretty good. And he was in command of, I think, Stafford was. He had three Americans that went up and two Russians. And the docking collar, what they call that, the androgynous docking collar. It didn't matter if it was a male or female type of situation, it would dock either way. And Russians actually invented the thing, but, they had it on the front end of their spacecraft, and we had the matching part on the American side, and that all deorbited. The Russian spacecraft is still similar to what they have today. You know, you have basically three components of the Russian Soyuz spacecraft. You have the crew quarters and landing craft, which is the center of these three little modules that are involved with the Soyuz spacecraft. And that's where the heat shield is and everything. Toward the back, they have the propulsion module, which is, naturally has all the fuel and thrusters and everything for maneuvering in space. And of course, you know, before they land, they eventually jettison that, and they jettison the front piece too. The front piece, another round spear. So you have three spears. In the back, you have the propulsion. In the middle, you have the crew cabin, you know, where they launch and where they land. And then you have the orbital module, and that's the front part. And the front part is where you can go in and, you know, you can eat in there. It's a little more roomy, of course, than the, you know, the crew cabin. They have a bathroom in there and all, sleeping quarters. And in the front of that, that's where this docking mechanism is. And where it is still today when they dock with the space station. That's pretty much it, Dick. Back to that, WS2N.
You probably know that I met Deke Slayton after Apollo 15. I had a chance to visit the Houston Space Center. Saw Stuart Russert on the training. Got in, escorted around by a couple of the NASA engineers. Can't even remember the name of my main contact person who I had been mailing letters to that I cleared all this with, but I met Deke Slayton, and he wasn't very happy to meet me because I was showing him pictures of hardware, a 12-foot homebrew dish that was listening to the Apollo astronauts when they were on the high-gain antenna. So his private deep space network communication to his astronauts, because he was in charge of astronaut training at the time, from his point of view, it had just become a party line because this guy, KQRIW, was listening in on his astronauts during the time. They're not connected to the networks. So, Deke Slayton did fly. What mission did he fly on? Was it Apollo Soyuz? Or, I don't think it was Skylab, but which one of those missions did he finally fly on after they gave him clearance? Over to you, Paul, KQRIW.
Yeah, that was the Apollo Soyuz mission. That's what he flew on. And he was a good guy. And then eventually, you know, he died not, you know, maybe what, 10, 15 years ago. So Orbital ATK, when they launched Cygnus spacecraft up to space, well, they're there, Cygnus spacecraft that goes to the International Space Station, they named after deceased astronauts, John Foss and, you know, different people that have died. And the last one was called Deke Slayton 2. And Deke Slayton 2, what happened to Deke Slayton 1? Well, that was back, you know, two Octobers ago when it was called Deke Slayton. And it got off the launch pad in Wallops, Virginia, and blew up. And that's what caused all the problems with the Russian engines. And, you know, Orbital ATK has to redo everything. Eventually, they're going to be flying out of Wallops again. But for now, they're flying out of Florida on the Atlas V. But yeah, that was they named it after Deke Slayton. So naturally, the last flight that went up to the International Space Station from Florida, they call that Deke Slayton 2. Back to you, Dick.
So, sounds like Deke Slayton did have a heart attack, or a heart problem. The astronauts on Apollo 15, Scott Worden and Irwin, during the re-entry, during the leaving of the moon on the way back toward Earth, Irwin did have a heart arrhythmia that was shown by the telemetry. In other words, the physician down at Houston monitoring the equipment connected to the astronauts on Apollo 15 as they had done their, I think they were unloading the equipment from the lunar lander into the command module. At that time, during that operation, Irwin, I think, had been up for quite a number of hours, and they recognized the fact that his heart was showing irregular beats. Irwin did give a astronaut speech to the high school students of Babylon High School a few years after that. I remember meeting him, and his heart problem did eventually create a difficulty where he died at age 61. So not all these extremely healthy astronauts get out from under heart problems. I wonder if you ever have a chance to ever meet any of the astronauts or be present at any of their Long Island presentations, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
No, I haven't met any of them. Not one. Tried once. By the way, Irwin, he was happy. He, even after he retired as an astronaut, he had weird goals. I mean, he went on a big expedition on the Himalayas or some mountain somewhere out in the middle of nowhere. He was looking for a Noah's Ark. I remember reading a story about him. He was out there. He was a very adventurous guy. And he was going to let a little heart murmur slow him down. So I think he had a full life. But, you know, it's a shame they couldn't catch it. Maybe nowadays they would have done something, you know, heart transplant or something. Who knows? Pretty common. And I would say I came close to meeting Neil Armstrong. He had going to give a speech on this gigantic tent out east down there, off exit 68. And they had this whole facility set up with tents. And I went out there and they said the public was going to be invited. There was all kinds of security with big canine dogs all around, and hey, you weren't getting near this place. I don't know what they were thinking. Anybody that showed up to meet him got turned away. Back to you, Dick. Oh, I want to mention one thing. Forgot to mention about a couple of weeks ago, I mentioned the launch of all these different vehicles that are going to Mars by the European Space Agency. I said that NASA didn't have any involvement with them. It was true they were going to be involved early on, but money dried up on NASA's side, and they backed out and they got involved with our Roscosmos, and that's where they are today.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
UHF radios on board all of these vehicles that are going. There's three of them, and it's called the Elektra radio system, ELECTRA. And they're the radios that they use on all the European space station. Any of the radios going to Mars that need to be sent via a repeater, which is the orbital spacecraft or to the Deep Space Network, are being built by NASA. They're involved with that. So we do have equipment on board all the all those spacecraft. I want to correct that. Back to you, Dick.
So you tried meeting Neil Armstrong. I was a little bit luckier than you. I met him twice. By met him, I mean I was in the same room with him, two people away, so to speak, as various people were going around talking to him. The reason I had that opportunity is because he became chairman of the board of AIL, Airborne Instruments Laboratory. And it was, I think, primarily a figurehead situation. I don't think he really did a lot of leadership, but I'm not sure about that. But each time we knew we were going to be in the same room with him, we were instructed ahead of time, do not ask that question. Was it one small step for a man? We were specifically told ahead of time, do not ask that question. When it comes to, let me drop quick. As you can tell, I saw him, I was alongside of him, so to speak, but never got a chance to directly talk to him. Irwin, I think I can tell by the talk he gave at the Babylon High School, he appeared to me to be a fairly religious guy. And I'm not sure, but I believe he had what he thought was a religious encounter of some kind while he was on the moon. Also on Apollo 11, Armstrong and Aldrin walked on the moon, and Aldrin, I think, had a kind of religious experience while he was on the moon. As such, I don't know if they did it together or independently. I think they each went to Mount Ararat looking for Noah's Ark. I think they both did that, Paul. Does that seem to make a little bit of sense? WS2N, K2RIW.
I remember reading about Irwin going. Yeah, I know they're into religion. And, a lot of the guys are. I mean, Aldrin, I don't think he went. But, you know, he brought the Eucharist up with him to the, you know, onto the moon and kept it quiet. Asked Neil Armstrong if he cared what he was doing. Neil couldn't care less, so. But, you know, you read these stories later on. The Genesis story, when they read Genesis for Apollo 8, they did a swing around the moon, returned to Earth. All the atheists went nuts and wanted to sue NASA. You know, you're wasting money on religion time. but it still goes on. You know, even today, worldview I've talked about before, they plan on, within a year or so, on sending people up on these balloons to look at the curvature of the Earth from over 100,000 feet up. And, charging them money to do that, and now they picked this pilot, and the pilot is the is an ex or astronaut, and he's got all these spiritual things. You know, he's a spiritual kind of guy. Ron Garan, he's written a book, Orbital Perspective. It's supposed to be pretty good. It's supposed to be a very good book, but you know. You got both kinds. You got the Russians out there that, you know, if they tripped over God, they wouldn't know who he was. They go up and come back. They don't even think about it. Back to you, Dirk.
In the case of Apollo 8, which did that figure eight path around the backside of the moon, I'm not sure whether or not it went into a lunar orbit and then came back out. I think it maybe did. But that event occurred during the week of Christmas. So the fact that the astronauts are not going to do any landing, they're in orbit around the moon, they've got a lot of spare time, it was the Christmas holiday, it was a brand new breakthrough of a man going further in space than ever, really going to the moon for the first time, without landing. So that being a significant event during the Christmas holiday, to read Genesis from the Bible, I can't see how anybody can be angry about that. No matter how secular you are, no matter how non-religious you are, it appealed to a certain percentage of religious people, and I'm having trouble believing that somebody could be offended by that at that time. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul, for any comments on that, and then pass it around, see if anyone else wants to address any of the above. You got it, Paul.
Toledo, I have something to ask on this subject.
Okay, let me go to Paul first, and then I'll go over to you, Rich. Go ahead, Paul.
Well, just the atheists, I guess they have an atheist group, I don't know. You know, I wouldn't mind being an atheist, but then you don't get any holidays, you know. It's an old joke, but I can't imagine. You got a larger subgroup, but this group did not want anything to do they went nuts when they found out about this. You know, I understand they sued, but I don't think they got any money. But NASA said, you know, we got to cut all the stuff out, so they kept things quiet about, you know, religion, keep it, you know, under your hat. And I'm sure they did. So, Apollo 8 just did a swing around and came back. Just actually, like Apollo 13, you know, it was designed that way as a safety type of thing. If you go into orbit, now you got to have your engine fire and come back. they weren't ready for that. I think the first time that we did that would be Apollo 10. We went and they did 10 orbits, and then they came back, and then 11 went and landed. They did, you know, of course they orbited as well. Whatever, just wanted to say something. Back to you, Dick.
N2EO, K2RIW, wait for the beep, and you got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick, thank you. I've been very quiet, but I've been listening since about 8:30. What kind of religious experience do these astronauts have? I wonder if you know in particular, and do they have the same experience? The reason I ask, you may remember, well, you may have heard me say, I was born Jewish, but since a little child, I was pulled toward Christ, and in my early 20s, I became a born-again Christian. That's why I'm asking, did they have the same experience, or in what religion? Do they think the same religion, Jewish, Christian, whatever? Back to that, and to you.
I don't think I know the particulars, Rich. Maybe Paul does. I think Irwin was a Protestant. I don't think he was Catholic. I don't think he was Jewish. But there, I'm not sure. I wonder if you know any of the particulars of the so-called religious experience that either of those astronauts thought they had while they were on the moon. I wonder if you know any of those details, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
I don't remember anything specific, but you know, you've had all kinds of religions go up there. You've had Eon. What was his name? Eon. How could I forget his last name? He died on STS-107. You know, the Columbia flight. He was the first all Jewish guy to go up there from Israel. But you know. All the different religions have been up there. We even sent a guy from Saudi Arabia, one of these princes, in one of the earlier flights. People don't know that either. We trained him as an astronaut, blasted him up there. So I'm sure he was Muslim. So, you know, you've had all kinds. And as far as anything specific, I don't know. The only thing I ever heard of was Mitchell. He was on Apollo 14 with Alan Shepard, but he didn't say he had a religious experience. He had an ESP experience. He planned on it anyway, but he had made some prearrangements with some people on Earth that he was going to try to contact them spiritually, you know, and ESP, and well, if you've heard me talk, I don't believe in any of it. Back to you, Dick. WS2S.
I think I've sent you the pictures. What have I found?
Okay, I'm gonna look at that picture while we turn it over to Rich. And I thank you for sending us that picture. And I'll be able to figure out. It's quite possible. I mean, from what you're saying, Wes, that there's a kind of capacitor used in Russia that maybe we in the United States don't know about, and maybe there's a partial solution to the problem I had, which was a very difficult problem. And by the way, that so-called flapper capacitor, I keep saying that Ed Menz is the guy who helped me invent that. Ed Menz is K2LCK, K2 Lima Charlie Kilo. And he was quite pivotal in helping me develop that flapper capacitor, which solved a very difficult problem for me. I mean, I couldn't use any of the techniques of the rotary joints that were being designed for megawatt levels by K2 TK. Oh, listen, I've forgotten his name. I mentioned his name earlier. The engineer who partially invented the strip line and was a rotary joint expert at AIL. It'll come to me in a minute. Let me drop it.
Did you read QSC yet this month? The April edition.
I have the April issue of QSC, and it's got a beautiful article. If you look at the It Seems to Us section, in which the CEO, David Sumner, talks about his retirement and his passion for ham radio, and the speech that he gave at the National Convention, which talks about what hams have done. In particular, he's pointing out that Mr. Claude, K1JT, Joe Taylor, who won a Nobel Prize for his discovery of the change in orbital period of
KQH,
recognize, we'll get to you in a second, the change in orbital period of a binary pulsar, and that it was indicating gravity waves. So ham radio was there doing some very interesting things. Let me first go over to Rich, who's on the waiting list, and then we'll go over to the other person. Rich, I'm sure that each person having what he thinks is a religious experience, it is my guess, I'm not sure, that it's a rather private thing. Did he hear a voice? Did something happen that was extraordinary to him? And the chances of two separate astronauts at two separate periods having the exact same experience, I think is unlikely, but I'm not sure. N2EO with that question, K2RIW in the TechNet.
1 second, Mr. WS. I just wanted to make sure you read that article, Dick, because that's exactly what I was going to bring up. Very well, very good speech. That.
Very fine, Paul, and yes, I did read it. N2EO, go ahead, Rich.
Oh, am I getting over to N2EO?
Yes, you are. Yes, you are. Go right ahead.
Okay, Dick. Many Paul. Many of you related to Paul. I was very much like you or Paul. Many can find out from me what experiences they have had if they were visited by the Holy Spirit while on the moon. That's all. Yeah, Dick.
My name is Dick.
And I heard your question, Rich, so I'll look into it. I did hear you.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's important to me for personal reasons and to me.
Boy, is that showing up on the map. We know exactly who it is. N2QR, go right ahead with your question, sir. K2RIW.
KD2, KQH.
KD2, KQH, go right ahead.
It's KD2, KQS right here. I've been listening to you guys for a while. Very interested in the whole astronaut experience. My theology input here, I'm perplexed by the notion that you may have individuals that are Christian, Muslim, Jewish, Zoroastrian, and they all have religious experiences when they are personally involved in a particular event. I happen to be atheist, and I've been involved in situations that I might describe as a religious experience in the loosest sense. But how do we explain that?
We all have a large number of things that happen to us in a lifetime. And we all have a brain that tries to figure out what's going on. Mother Nature sometimes is talking to us. What's the message? How do radio waves really behave? How do gravity waves really propagate? I mean, there's a zillion questions. We only partially understand this universe. And if it was invented by an omnipresence, a deity, he certainly didn't invent it to be simple for us to understand. But was it done by some intelligence, or did it happen? And that can be discussed until the cows come home, if you know what I mean. So, people will put a coincidence interpretation. I mean, if I'm thinking of somebody I haven't seen for 20 years, and I start thinking about that person, and 10 minutes later they call me on the phone, obviously I would correlate that. It could be a pure coincidence, or it could be that we both watched a particular television program, so to speak, and that television program made him think of me and made me think of him, if you know what I mean. Sometimes there's a good explanation for what looks like an extraordinary experience. That's a guess on my part, Kevin. KD2, KQS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Not looking to diminish anybody's personal worldview and spirituality. I'm just always curious when people try to assign a value to someone else's experience, which is very unique. And like I said, I've experienced things that, wow, can't explain it at all. Like you said, I've been on the top of mountains and gotten as close to, if there is a God, as close to the God as it gets. But disparate astronauts that I've never met and trying to assign a religious value to what they experienced, I'm at a loss.
Almost every objective person to some degree would have to be at a loss in that situation, Ken. That kind of a experience is an extremely personal one. I mean, we've all been equipped with a certain brain that has a certain degree of ability to analyze things. We've all been exposed to a particular environment. And you put that all together, and therefore we come up with certain opinions as to what's real, what's not real, what's religious, and so on. We've all got opinions. That's all we got to go on, if you know what I mean. And if you're an objective person, you try to research it and try to make it more accurate, more traceable to the Bureau. You try to read articles that are more authoritative. You try not to be sucked in by nut papers, so to speak. Let me drop it. The internet, for instance, is an extremely large source of information, education, data. But a certain percentage of what's on that internet is not good stuff. If you are really selective, you can choose a number of authoritative sounding articles on the internet that will convince you that everybody using a cell phone is putting himself at risk of getting brain cancer. There's lots of articles saying that. The objective articles seem to say there's no good evidence of that. And what I understand about RF energy, I mean, the way the human brain works, just for this one for an instance, the human brain is dissipating something like 35 watts of continuous metabolism while you're awake. It may be a little bit lower than that when you're asleep, but 35 watts of the energy going to your body. Your body is dissipating 135 watts continuously, and 25 watts of that is going on between your ears. And the blood flow between all those cells is doing a beautiful job of cooling off all of that heat that's being generated by that 25 watts. Let me drop it. So the natural metabolism of a brain is creating 25 watts. The blood flow is keeping it from going to some ridiculously high temperature. Now you hold a cell phone against your ear, and it's dissipating. If the cell phone is running high power, it's running 200 or 300 milliwatts, 2 or 3 tenths of a watt on the outside of your head, and you want to believe that that's going to create thermal injury or RF injury of an organ that's all by itself dissipating 25 watts. And you look at the mathematics of that, the chances of that being real are very, very slim. Not zero, but very, very slim. And we've now got 20 or 30 years of experience with cell phones, and no one has been able to confirm that they create cancer. But because it's called RF radiation, that magical word, that terrible sounding word, let me drop it.
On the older, I've learned to just kind of hang back and just watch the world go by, just have a front row seat in the circus, as it were.
That's one way of looking at it, Kevin, and maybe you're right. We all make mistakes. And if you're rational, you kind of laugh at your mistakes and proceed. You could hang yourself up forever because you've made some mistakes. We're going to. And so the word RF radiation, we're going to believe that that's cancer-causing. Well, RF radiation and nuclear radiation have nothing to do with each other. But because they both have that common word, radiation, and nuclear radiation, yes, can be cancer-causing. So people form an association there that is not real. But if you really want to be super safe, You can always hold your cell phone out at a distance and talk to it by way of a headset, if you know what I mean. A Bluetooth headset. And don't even connect it to a belt clip. Don't even have it close to your body. If you want to be super safe, you can do that. You don't have to. But, I mean, we amateurs work with kilowatts of RF energy. And as long as you don't do something really foolish, we have good reason to believe it's very safe. You take that 1,000 watts you put into that 80-meter dipole, and most of that energy is being spread over that wire 132 feet long. And you stand near that wire, the amount that you can absorb is a very small fraction of that. And the magic about 3.5 megacycles is that most of it doesn't get absorbed by a human being. Most of it passes right through with no reaction. It's part of those frequency regions that you can read about in the C95 report. It's a very free, very safe frequency region, so to speak. Let me drop. So, you got to be careful what you read. You got to be careful how you interpret what people have. And when it comes to religion, it's a very personal thing to many people. And so what they interpret as a religious experience, I mean, we gain nothing by attacking them, even if we were absolutely positive they're wrong. There's no way we can be positive they're wrong. If it gives them comfort to believe that, let them believe it as I see it. Live and let live is sort of my attitude. I think, but in your attitude of let the world go by and its craziness, I think you also have a somewhat live and let live attitude. Isn't that true, Kevin? KD2QKQS, K2RIW, go ahead, Kevin.
You are 1,000% on point in your assessment of my worldview. I don't like to talk about it in front of mixed company, but I am a practicing stoic. And in that vein, I have my world that I live in, and it is going to do what it is going to do. And the only thing that I have control of is my perception of that and my actions. So we can all drive ourselves nuts, but the world will turn, as it were. And but that was real nice. Really, even talking with scientifically, what you're talking about with RF frequencies and radioactivity. I will let you know, though, that my tinfoil hat has absolutely made me impervious to any of this stuff, so I don't have to worry about it. I jest. But, I think what.
Dick, I wanted to give you the name of that one astronaut from Israel. I remember his name here.
Go ahead, Paul, and then we'll go over to. Ed number two, then we're going to go over to Mike number two after that. Go ahead, Paul.
Eon Ramon, R-A-M-O-N. He was the guy involved with the sprites. He wanted to take all the pictures of the sprites and everything. And eventually a guy from Japan went up in a shuttle, and he finished it, what this guy started, looking for the sprites at the top of the these lightning bolts that would hit the ground, pictures from outer space. So I know you remember that story, but that was his name.
A phenomenon of those sprites, and not easy to explain what's going on. Some very high energy physics there. I think it was K1MJM, if that was you, Mike, go right ahead. Okay, who was the other person who wanted to say something? Give me a call, let us proceed.
It's me, W.H. Warrior. Well, I have a question for you, and unrelated to what you're talking about right now, but very simply, did you get the wire I sent you, hoping that will solve your problems if they should arise in the future?
Yes, I did, and I thank you. There was another comment I was going to make here. Oh, yeah. Kevin, that tin hat to protect you, that does a good job. Only if you use the tin that's got the aluminum foil that's got the blue coloring to it. You got to make sure you get that particular one. This was TechNet number 1594. We're coming up to the bewitching hour in which we're about to be cut off. You heard the space report number 193. Which is a little bit different than the usual ones. And I'm going to pass it around to the R group to tie the ribbons on it. Hey, John, what color is your little Energy. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet. Gotta make sure you use the right color.
Oh yeah, I have the blue one. Oh, nothing but the best. I think it still leaks in though, Dick. It's a parity cage, it doesn't work too well. But I know it keeps my thoughts inside, I don't get those out. Alright, well, I'd like to thank everybody for joining the net tonight, and the questions and letters that came in, very interesting stuff. Keep it coming, that's what we're here for. And if everything goes well, we're going to meet here again next week at the same time, at the same repeater. And good night, Paul, Dick, everyone on the net. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Dick, did you get my email? Because one was returned, but I said another one.
I'm going to look at that in a minute. I'll pass it over to Paul while I look at that. WS2N, Paul, thank you for all that research that you do. How the hell do you keep all of these people and all those spacecraft steady? You must have a great big notebook in which you keep notes on all this. Either that, you've got a photographic memory, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Understand. I advanced to the tablet. I used that tablet when you were up here. That's as far as I got. Plenty of memory cells. I can't remember anything else except this. That's the problem. Very good, Dick. Have a very good night. I'll look forward to a launch on Tuesday at 11:35. Tuesday night. That would be a Orbital Science. That's the one going off from Florida. That will be transmitted on NASA TV. So that's always pretty cool to look at. Unless it's bad weather and then they scrub the launch. Back to you, Dick.
35. I'm looking at the photograph of this spiral spring fed thing. Looking at photograph number one. And I see the two cookie cutters, so to speak, that are cut in half and they mesh when they're rotated. Okay. I see a bearing there. I see a shaft and a bearing. Let me go over to the other picture. Mailed me a total of two pictures. Same picture. Okay. That knob is connected to a shaft. That shaft is going through a housing. That knob through that shaft or that housing is moving a metallic object that changes the area between the left-hand complicated structure and the right-hand complicated structure. Why would RF current not be flowing through that shaft and that rotary bearing, Wes? I'm guessing that this is a Russian-made high-energy capacitor, but it might not be able to work at 432 at high power. Maybe I'm misinterpreting the picture. Thank you for researching that picture and sending it to us. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yantuxian. It is not exactly the same capacitor, but it's the same concept. They've been doing regular butterfly capacitor the same way and working at a very high frequencies. Now, if you look at the drawing that I have made, because I couldn't find exactly the same one, on the right-hand side, you see two plates that are marked ceramic supporting plates. And then on the side, you have something smaller outside of the ceramic plates. And those are the spring contacts. They are conducting spring. On the left-hand side of the drawing, you have actually the picture how those springs are being built. And then you have a shaft. On that shaft, I didn't draw the plates, but you can imagine that the plates are there. And it's being called shaft with rotating plates. Picking it up. Now, when you move the shaft, the spring is getting tighter, but you don't have any bearings or any connection. Now, the first picture that I have sent you, if you imagine that the lower part, the L bracket at the bottom of it, of the first picture is made out of the ceramic, then you don't have a bearing at all. Now, the shaft that is connected to the wheel that is then connected to the mechanism of the steering it on that big picture, the regular picture, is made of the ceramic as well. Now, imagine that from the other side of that, you have that spring that is on the drawing. Now, you have no contact, No sliding contacts. The spring is getting tighter. And that's how it works. Enter again.
Okay, the lower picture, the image, if that mechanism that's supporting it and allowing it to rotate, if that's made out of ceramic, then yes, there would be no sliding contacts. And yes, that could solve the problem. It's a little bit more elaborate than my technique, quite a bit more elaborate. But that would solve it if that support structure was ceramic. Now, the upper picture with the spiral spring, I'm not able to see how the variable capacitance takes place. Is that a spiral-shaped metal plate on the left side and a spiral-shaped metal plate on the right side? And I presume they come close to each other, and the amount of overlap changes as one rotates versus the other. Is that roughly true over the U.S.?
You've got another one that works over 1 gigahertz. That was when they, how they built the capacitors based on changing the distance between the plate. That was the another one. But this one is pretty much straightforward. On the drawing, imagine that you have a stator which are not moving plates, and they are fixed. And then on the chart that is in the moving plates, you have a plate that are moving. But there is no contact because the contact is made through the spring on the left-hand side and right-hand side. Do you picture it now?
Does RF current flow through that spring?
That is correct.
That's not good.
No, it is good. Look, you have a contact point. Do you see the contact point there? The spring is not a wide spring. You have only one short spring that is enough just to give you enough rotation of in and out. Enter again.
If the spring has enough inductance so that the RF current flowing through it becomes very small because of a lot of inductive reactants, maybe that can work. But if the spring has RF current flowing through it, that partially negates the effect I'm looking for, Wes. Go ahead.
The Russians have designed this stuff so the spring change capacitance or whatever the reactive components of it are added into the total change of the capacitance between the plates. That means it's a part of the structure of the capacitor. But because you have as you see in here, you don't have even a two or three coils of this spring. You have just half of a coil of the spring, and then on the top of it, you have something that is smaller. And that one was actually made out of the flexible but not conductive material. It was just to hold that the spring cannot be turned over 90 degrees. So think about the outer part that says the contact point on it. Let me stop.
Could the spring be made out of a non-conductive material?
That is correct. That is correct. The smaller spring is made out of the non-conductive material. The other spring on the same side, you have two lines, is made from conductive material. Enter again.
Why is the outer spring conductive material? Is that in order to ground that particular plate?
No, it is not. The other spring, that one that is outside, is made from the conductive material, but the inner spring is actually non-conductive but flexible one, stopping you from overdoing it. If you try to turn that capacitor more than 90 degrees, it's going to stop because it's short. Enter again.
I can see that. You've got a top view, you've got a front view. I still don't see how it goes together. I think I need an isometric view, if that's possible, Wes.
I'm going to try to find it. It was the Russian secret, but it was in plenty of high-tech Russian from 60s and 70s. It was plenty. Now, the capacitor looks like the one on the picture. The distance between the plates